You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get a recap of Governor Evers' State of the State address last night.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a musical poem.
January is National Polka Month. And what better place to commemorate this iconic sound than in Wisconsin, where the polka is our state dance. To celebrate, poet Susan Fearer shares a poem about her sister's accordion and her mother's irritation. It's called 1956, the year my sister, using her ill health once again, blackmailed my parents into an accordion.
My mother even hated the name of the store where she had to pick it up. Low Duca Brothers. She waited until dark to smuggle it from our old holiday trunk into our house. To my mother, the accordion was an immigrant, one of my father's relatives, one that didn't speak English, one that was pierogi fat that wore a babushka and anklets to church, one she thought she had talked him out of writing to. My sister would go out on my parents' suburban front lawn, between the maple and chinaberry tree, on the even, green, Bay Ridge, well-watered lawn, and practice Lady of Spain. My mother imagined the clouds above her house taking Lawrence Welk cutout shapes at Rankolakis. Frankie Yankovic was at her door. The neighbors knew. My mother hoped my sister would abandon the accordion as quickly as she did her charm school, her twirling, her water ballet, and Mamie Eisenhower scrapbook. My mother dreamt the six fat Dutchmen heard all about her sick daughter and came and taught her the two fat polka. All my father's unrecognized relatives came from Czechoslovakia to see the six fat Dutchmen and do the Slovenian twirl in twilight under plastic electric Chinese lanterns strung around my parents' newly landscaped suburban lot. My mother bribed my sister away from her accordion with a trip to New York to visit Uncle Jack, a professor who taught labor relations at Cornell. It was what my sister wanted all along. The accordion was her wardrobe door to Narnia, New York. While they were gone, the accordion sat alone as the night convent of St. Mary of Częstochowa. The accordion had rows of knobs of wonderful black buttons. I wasn't big enough to carry it. It was beauty. I imagined it vast and pearl as a confessional, gay as a polka fest. I sat next to it. I heard my sister's silent accordion stop playing the past. It began playing music I didn't know yet. Years later, I'd call it Zydeco and dance to it on sweet, full summer nights on side city streets of the future with holy card beautiful men who loved nothing more than a woman with an ear for a good accordion and all the musics one can make.
Susan Fearer is the former poet laureate of Milwaukee and the author of many books, including Milwaukee Does Strange Things to People. And if you want more accordion in your life, check out Wisconsin Public Television's recent story, Accordion is All in the Family. It's about lifelong accordion player Ruth Marty, her bandmate and granddaughter, Sarah, and an annual concert they host in New Glarus. You can find that story at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, Governor Tony Evers delivered his first State of the State address last night.
He hit a lot of themes that were key to his campaign for governor, and he also introduced some new plans as well.
WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson was at the address. He joins us now. Sean, good to have you back with us.
Hey, Rob.
So, overall tone, what did we hear from Governor Evers before we dig into details?
I think tone-wise, it was kind of a mix of what you've heard from Evers, not only in the campaign, but since the campaign, where he's talking about bipartisanship, bipartisanship, bipartisanship. We have to work together on things. That's what the people expect. At the same time, this speech was a little bit more aggressive than some other Evers addresses. I mean, he was at the same time saying that, you know, Republicans need to respect the will of the people. They need to follow his budget, not create their own. And he announced that he was doing his part to get Wisconsin out of a lawsuit that Republicans support, and a lawsuit that they passed a law to try to keep Wisconsin locked into, basically.
And staying with that theme, here's how Governor Evers' speech started off.
We are a state forged by the Wisconsin idea, the notion that education informs our public policy, and that knowledge should embrace the communities we're called to serve. But today, we're also a state among the worst to raise a black family. And we're a state that's spending more on corrections than our entire University of Wisconsin system.
Now, we heard a lot about racial disparities and kids in poverty, et cetera. Is it unusual for an administration of a new party in power to point out a lot of negatives in their first State of the State speech?
So I went back and looked at Governor Walker's first State of the State speech, knowing that we were going to talk about this. And there was a lot of negative in Governor Walker's speech. So economic times were different then. We were coming out of a recession. The state budget was in much worse shape. But then Governor Walker's address was sharply critical of his predecessor. So I don't think it's too unusual for Governor Evers to come out and say, we need to do things better here. After all, that's what he ran on. I think what the issues that he chose to highlight are different than you've heard, you know, Governor Walker highlight when he came into office, though. To raise those issues early on in his speech was a change for Evers.
Getting into some of the particulars here, you mentioned this seemed like maybe the newsiest part of it. And you mentioned it, Sean, Governor Evers saying, yeah, I'm directing the Attorney General to get us out of the Affordable Care Act lawsuit. Not clear whether he can do that. Some of the lawyers for the state legislature have looked at this, said, yeah, with this new law he passed, I don't think we can do that. Do we know how this is supposed to work?
So what happened today is that the nonpartisan attorneys, a nonpartisan attorney for the legislature, authored a memo at the request of Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, one of the legislature's top Republicans, where Fitzgerald said, can the governor do this? And the Legislative Reference Bureau's take was that a governor cannot withdraw the attorney general from a lawsuit, that is the power of the legislature's budget committee now under a law that Republicans passed in the lame duck session in December and Governor Walker signed in December. So the LRB, the Nonpartisan Legislative Reference Bureau, is saying they can't do that. The governor's office is saying today that the governor has not directed the attorney general to take any specific course in this, that the governor has simply withdrawn his authority for this lawsuit. That kind of puts it in Josh Call's court, not literal court, but we have not heard from Attorney General Call yet what he's going to do now. So it's basically his decision whether or not he wants to stay in this or he wants to tread back out of it. If he does, that would probably end up in court.
And the new governor had said something at one point about directing the attorney general to change the state's stance in this lawsuit. Is there some sort of legal, or is there a thought that there might be some kind of legal wiggle room where we don't withdraw from it, which appears to be banned by this new law, but we do something that makes us not a plaintiff in it anymore?
I'm just not sure about that. His letter that he sent to Attorney General Call, withdrawing, his backing of this lawsuit was really brief. And so now it sounds like it's kind of Call's decision here. If he pulls out of the lawsuit, that's probably going to lead to kind of a counter lawsuit by Republicans or a Republican group. And then you've got a separation of powers issue, the legislature versus the governor and the attorney general. And that could be, would be ultimately decided by the courts.
Sean, we heard Governor Evers say or use the phrase connect the dots a lot. What did he mean when he said that?
It seems like when Governor Evers talks about that, he's saying that you have to look at everything. You have to kind of look at the big picture when you're talking about education, for example. I think that was the example that he used in his speech. He said it's about seeing the connection between how lack of access to affordable housing affects kids in the classroom. It's about seeing the connection between drug and alcohol addiction and our burgeoning criminal justice system. So Evers is saying the people in his administration need to make those connections, connect the dots. And that's sort of what he was laying out in his speech last night.
We're talking with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He's recapping Governor Evers' State of the State address, which was delivered at the Capitol last night.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the top issues that you hope to see the Evers administration work on? How hopeful are you that the Democratic administration and the Republican legislature can work together? Do you think there's room for bipartisan efforts should Wisconsin drop out of the Affordable Care Act lawsuit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is with us. We're continuing our breakdown of last night's State of the State address.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch the State of the State? What was your reaction? Did you like what you heard, or did you disagree with the priorities that Governor Evers laid out? What do you wish you heard more of, either from Governor Evers or Assembly Speaker Robin Voss? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us here at Central Time WPR.
Another big issue in the campaign for governor in the State of the State address last night and probably in the months to come, Sean, what Governor Evers had to say about health care. Here's a listen to his talk about using federal funds to expand Medicaid in Wisconsin.
We have a real opportunity here, folks. And at the end of the day, Mr. Majority Leader and Mr. Speaker, health care should not be a partisan issue. You know, Republican states like Kentucky and Nebraska and Idaho have expanded Medicaid, and so have Democratic states such as Washington, California, and Minnesota. We should be able to get it done here, too.
Governor Evers making the case there for accepting federal Medicaid funds. He says he's going to take this to the people. Republican lawmakers not on board with this at this point, Sean.
No, not. I mean, especially when you listen to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss talk about this, he's saying no way, basically. In fact, his no gets more emphatic, it seems like, as this goes on. And Evers says he's going to push for it, though. This is, you know, significant for any number of reasons, but first of all, it's a big policy change for people who are above 100% of the poverty level, but you know, maybe up to 133% of the poverty level. This would be a chance for them to get increased funding for Badger Care, for Medicaid. It would, but I think in terms of this political conversation we're having and the argument between Speaker Voss and Governor Evers, this is a significant piece of the state budget, because if Wisconsin were to take the Medicaid expansion, that frees up about $280 million a year in state funding that Governor Evers could use for other things, other priorities, tax cuts, education funding, et cetera. If that money's not there, then it's a completely different budget. And so, you know, we've heard from Governor Evers that he's going to keep pushing for this. It's not just a political message here. It's a pretty significant piece of the budget, whether it's in or out.
Speaking of Speaker Robin Voss, he delivered the Republican address, and here's part of what he had to say.
It's clear, no matter what you've heard, the state of our state is incredibly strong. You simply can't ignore the facts, no matter how much some people want to. The Wisconsin unemployment rate is at its 11th straight month at or below 3%. Despite what we heard tonight, new businesses are up nearly 7% just this past year.
So two really different pictures of the state from Governor Evers and Speaker Voss. So how should we reconcile those?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about numbers, unemployment is low right now. There's no way around that. And when you're talking about the budget, it's in okay shape right now. I mean, it's not in pristine condition, but there's a sizable balance there that Republicans want to use to pay for a new round of tax cuts, These things are facts. So this is stuff that Republicans are highlighting, but they're really trying to take ownership of it. I mean, there's no nod to the fact that the national economy is in an upswing, a prolonged upswing, and that there's, you know, revenue to go around in other states, too. They're saying this is the Republican surplus. This is a result of Republican actions in Wisconsin. They're trying to own it, you know, kind of continuing what you heard from Governor Walker in his State of the State speeches. Robin Voss now carrying that message.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hello. What do you think?
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about Robin Voss's remarks after Tony Evers' speech. And he stuck in a kind of snide comment about the state turning socialist when Evers is trying to use the money that the state has for education for the future. Maybe we can get some of the roads fixed, which with the excess budget that the Republicans are bragging about, why haven't they spent money on transportation issues and the infrastructure.
Jacob, thanks a lot for the call. A couple points there. First of all, Jacob pointed to Speaker Voss saying that Democrats would move Wisconsin or want to move Wisconsin in a socialist direction.
Yeah, I mean, Voss doesn't tend to go for the soft statements when he's talking about where Democrats want to go. He tends to characterize Governor Evers as far left. Robin Voss will characterize accepting the federal Medicaid money as a far left position. That is a position that Republicans in other states have taken. But he uses strong terms when he's describing Democrats. He mixes it up, it's fair to say. When you're talking about funding for other stuff, roads, for example, Voss may be pretty close to Governor Evers in terms of what he wants to do. I mean, he was kind of the most outspoken advocate for some kind of new revenue tax or fee increase for roads in the last legislative session. We don't know what Governor Evers wants there yet, but we know that he's kind of been leaning that direction in his comments in the campaign. So those two might find some common ground there.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Barbara in Delafield. Good afternoon, Barbara. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Good afternoon. Hi. Well, I'm calling just really to talk about the Affordable Care Act. I have been so angry ever since they put that lawsuit in against the Affordable Care Act, because it's my tax money being used to do something that I don't agree with. And on the other side of the coin, I'm giving money to organizations who are trying to fight something like that. You know, so I'm giving to organizations that are, as far as I'm concerned, on the right side to try to get health care for people. And meanwhile, the government in my state is using the money that I have to pay to do the exact opposite. And I've been really angry, so I'm so glad he's trying to get us out of this.
Barbara, thank you so much for the call. Sean, what is the status on the ACA lawsuit right now, the Affordable Care Act lawsuit? Where do we go from here?
So the lawsuit itself, actually, the plaintiffs, Wisconsin and the other states who are suing to overturn the law, were successful in their, the opening battle, I guess you'd say. A federal judge in December overturned the entire law. Now, that ruling has been on hold while it's being appealed. You've heard a lot of legal analysts say that on appeal, they expect the ruling might not be so broad, that the judge went even farther than necessarily plaintiffs were asking for. But, that case is very much still out there, and it's hugely significant because, former Attorney General Brad Schimel said that, basically the entire Obamacare law could crumble, if this lawsuit is successful. It's a significant lawsuit. It's still alive. Wisconsin is still a part of it right now. And, you know, just to speak to the caller's frustration there, that is sort of Wisconsin. You have a divided state where government can sometimes switch back and forth between the parties. Half the state is often frustrated with the other half, I guess.
We heard, thanks for that call, Barbara. We heard from Mickey in Dodgeville, who says Speaker Voss sounds like he's ready to run for governor. It sounds like he was laying out a platform. So he's laying out a platform for legislative Republicans. I know you're not in Speaker Voss's mind, Sean, but is there speculation that he might be a candidate for governor in 4 years?
There was speculation, I think, around the last cycle that he might want to run. I mean, he was often at odds with Governor Walker. And, you know, at the moment, Governor Walker is not governor, and any Republican could theoretically run in 2022. So I don't think it's crazy to talk about Speaker Voss in that way, but there's a long time between now right. and then, and I imagine there'd be a lot of Republicans who would, you know, would look at that job and say, hey, that could be me.
There's a fellow who's been active on Twitter lately who might run, too. Walker? Scott something?
Yes,
Walker?
He has. But that's right. It seems like Governor Walker may be still running for something, whether it's U.S. Senate or governor. He's definitely staying in the public eye and, of course, has some name recognition that an assembly speaker probably would not.
Yeah, we've heard Voss calling attention to a number of policy areas that assembly Republicans think they can find common ground with Governor Evers on. Should we be expecting a lot of bipartisanship in this legislature?
There will be some kind of bipartisanship. It just met. I don't know if it's going to lead to laws. So yesterday, Assembly Republicans, with the help of a number of Assembly Democrats, passed a bill that would create new state protections for people with pre-existing conditions. This is something that Democrats had previously said didn't go far enough because it didn't include protection. You know, it didn't spell out essential benefits for health insurance. It didn't include prohibitions against lifetime caps on health insurance. So Republicans amended it yesterday, included a prohibition on lifetime caps, and they got a number of Democratic votes. I don't know if that's going to be enough to get Governor Evers' support. It's not everything that he asked for. I don't know if it's going to be enough to get a vote in the state Senate, but you do see some working together there. Whether or not it means anything in the end or it's all for show, I don't know.
Sean, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He was with us to recap last night's State of the State address by Governor Tony Evers.
Do you feel like you maybe pay too much for your internet? Do you even get to choose from more than one provider? Maybe you're in a rural area and reliable internet access isn't a real option for you. If you feel like we should be doing better than that by now, our next guest agrees with you.
She says fiber optic connections could transform what we know as a connected society and completely change the way we live and work. With many Asian and Northern European countries already relying on fiber to deliver and send their data, America has fallen behind.
Susan Crawford is a professor at Harvard Law School. She served as special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation policy in 2009. She's the author of many books, including her latest. It's called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate being here.
Now, let's start with the technology, because this is a huge part of your book. Compare fiber optic as cables as a system of internet delivery to all the other stuff that we have out there.
Well, what's amazing about fiber, it's just about magical, is that as far as we can tell, its capacity to carry data is unlimited. All you have to do once the glass is in the ground is upgrade the electronics at one end and the other. And you can say it's like a 15-mile-wide river compared to a little trickle of water for a traditional copper line. It's amazing. And it effectively creates for people just a glass wall between you and the rest of the world, a window, really, so that you can have eye contact and be present with people who are distant from you. We've never experienced that in the United States, but it's common in other countries.
Yeah, in the United States, I think we like to think of ourselves as pretty cutting edge. There's a new technology, a railroad, electricity, whatever. We're the first to get it. This is not the case. You've been traveling around the world to research this. What are other countries doing that we're not?
Well, it is shocking. And I've never been embarrassed to be an American. I'm very proud to be an American. But when I went to South Korea, and the Koreans told me that coming to America is like taking a rural vacation because life is so unconnected here. And the mayor of Stockholm grabbed me by the elbow and said, is there anything we can do to help? So basically what's happened is in the many Asian countries and several Northern European ones, this has just been like electricity or like a railroad, something that needs to connect the entire country. And there have been huge efforts on the policy level to ensure that every home and business is connected to fiber. And the real threat here is that China plans to connect 80% of their homes to fiber optic cable, which means they basically have very, very cheap, basically ubiquitous and unlimited connectivity. So new industries and new ways of making a living will come from those countries and not from the United States, which makes no sense. I mean, we should be looking the rest of the world in the rearview mirror. We're the ones who came up with the whole idea of the Internet. But because of a series of policy failures over the last 20 years, we've ended up just not really relevant on the communications screen with the rest of the world, and it's particularly in Asia and Northern Europe.
Before we dig into those policy questions, I want to take a little sidebar here, something you address in your book, something I've talked to you about in the past. People might think, well, I've got a phone. I get my Internet wirelessly. What do I care about fibers?
Well, that's exactly what people said when they only had enough electricity for a single light bulb in their house. You know, they used to call the electrical bill the light bill. No one thought about all the other things that could be connected to that electrical line, things like refrigeration, even kitchen cooking. That was all a mystery to a lot of people, and particularly in rural areas and also in poor parts of urban areas. It took a long time for electricity to get there. And when it arrived in the form of a single light bulb, people might have said, well, that's enough. I don't need anything else. Turns out you need a lot to live in the modern world. And so we make sure that every house has sort of the equivalent of a fiber optic connection when it comes to electricity. You've got enough to be sort of a member of the 21st century. That's part of the National Electric Code. But we don't have those kinds of requirements for homes and businesses. And so what's happening is we're relegating a lot of rural people and a lot of poor people in urban areas to the equivalent of a bike path when people in China will be on a superhighway.
Talking to Susan Crawford, her new book is called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Susan, you point the finger at one major culprit or a group of them, the companies that provide our Internet currently. They're monopolies in many areas. They've had a lot of policy sway. Can you talk about those companies and how they've affected the Internet we have access to?
Look, these aren't bad companies. They are great American firms like Comcast and Charter and AT&T. But for the last 15 years or so, they've been completely unrestrained, and which means they're under no obligation to serve everybody when it comes to high-speed Internet access. There are certainly no price limitations. But what they'll do in this instance, just because this is the way capitalism works, is they will choose particularly rich areas and wire them with second-class service, and they're under no particular pressure to upgrade it, and then carve up markets among themselves. And that's why in most areas you've basically got a cable company that never competes with any other cable company and perhaps a couple wireless offers, but not a lot of competition. And that also happened with railroads. Where you have these infrastructure elements of the economy that require enormous upfront investment, it really only makes sense for one operator to be present in a particular locality and to create competition by forcing that operator to share their lines. That's the way we've always done it with telecom in the past. But where you have no rules, which is what's going on in the United States right now, the private operators will just divide up the market among themselves and then charge as much as they can get away with to the markets they decide to serve. So what we're left with is pretty, as you described, pretty monopolized urban sector, mostly cable there, and very little investment in capital to upgrade their networks to fiber. A lot of rural areas completely left out or perhaps being pushed towards unreliable wireless connections. And a whole country that is essentially paying rent to about four or five companies because of the absence of any policy in this area.
You also point towards some local initiatives as you see as bright spots where local governments have taken the initiative in getting high-speed Internet. I want you to take us to Chattanooga, Tennessee, maybe not a place we think about that often from here in Wisconsin. You say they've done a lot of stuff. What's going on there?
Chattanooga has, and that's a nice mid-sized town that 300,000 people, they use their municipal electric provider to use those same lines to provide fiber optic across the city. And now they're providing 10 gigabit symmetric service. That means equal uploads and downloads. had a pretty low price to people in that city. And what's happened as a result is that they're seeing all kinds of new businesses show up and new ways of making a living there in Chattanooga, which used to be the dirtiest city in America, by the way. And they're now pivoting to take on other issues that are of a piece with this inequality in internet access, things like terrible education outcomes and health issues, and really making sure that their high school graduates are ready to take those jobs in advanced manufacturing that have come to Chattanooga because of it. But look, you've got a wonderful example right there in Wisconsin, which is not that far from Madison, Reedsburg. They were the first place in America, I believe, to offer routinely offer gigabit service to their subscribers. Again, based on a municipal electric utility, they had a proud history of providing electricity to everybody and then just pivoted to fiber. And so, as I understand it, for about $45 a month, you can get gigabit service in Reedsburg, particularly if you bundle it with telephone and other services. And the customer service is great. There's a local person who answers the phone. It's a beloved service. Same thing in Chattanooga. This is a whole new way of doing things. And especially as I, you know, turn on the radio and hear about the 33rd consecutive day of the federal government shutdown, it's wonderful to think of these local areas taking matters into their own hands and making sure that everybody has a chance to thrive in the 21st century economy.
And you write that we may have, when we think about this, kind of a failure of imagination. In the same way that we thought the electricity was the power to light bulbs in our house, we think of that connectivity as, okay, we play an online game, we stream some music, we post the cat video, whatever. You say economically and socially, there are like benefits we can't even think of yet until we have this kind of thing in place.
That's true, and we're an enormous market. If we got this right in the United States, if all these municipal networks eventually, and by the way, there are 800 different either municipal or cooperative networks in the United States these days, if that shaved the federal government into action, imagine all the kinds of things we could be doing. You could work where you live rather than having to live where you work. We could really address climate change by perhaps moving people out of harm's way into communities that are well served by communications, where they can have wonderful jobs, get a first-class education for their kids, no matter where they are, fantastic health services. But there's much more beyond that that, as you said, we really can't imagine, because nobody yet in the world has had access to a large market with new forms of fiber-based services. And the Chinese are going really fast in moving towards that. And I have hope that the United States will get the idea that we need to speed up.
We're talking to Susan Crawford from Harvard Law School. She's the author of the new book we're talking about. It's called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's the internet connection like in your area? If you live in a rural area, do you have access to reliable broadband? Would you support a nationwide fiber network the same way we have power lines and networks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We continue our conversation with Susan Crawford. She is a professor at Harvard Law School and the author of the new book, Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see change in our internet-connected world? Would you support a nationwide network of fiber optic cable, kind of like we have had for some time with electricity? If you live in a rural area, I'd love to hear from you. Do you have access to reliable internet at any speed? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lots of callers. Let's start with Ben in Lake Forest, Illinois. Ben, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Well, just a couple of things. First of all, I think it's important to emphasize that the existing telecommunications monopolies actually, in return for getting deregulation, agreed to put in fiber and reneged on most of those commitments. That's, I think, something important to remember here. So the fact that they were never enforced is, I think, should interest people. The second thing is this, that, you know, there's sort of like a race between how to use, say, something existing like copper more efficiently because of improvements in processing technology, in other words, to get more bandwidth out of existing stuff versus being able to use fiber and get the whole shebang to start with. And what's happened is that the existing telecom actors, of course, are trying to avoid spending any money on new infrastructure by playing that particular game. On the other hand, if people could actually, with some of these technologies, build their own local neighborhood networks and deal on a wholesale basis instead of on a retail basis with a telecom company. I mean, there are.
Ben, I'm gonna jump. We've got a lot of callers. You gave us a lot to work with, Susan. First of all, his history talking about deregulation for fiber. We got the deregulation. We didn't get the fiber. Is that about right?
There have been a lot of Lucy with the football moments in telecom history. Yes, and at the moment they're sitting very pretty with complete deregulation.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. He also mentioned telecoms trying to squeeze what they can out of existing copper wire or coaxial cable, where that is. Not so much with spending money to bring in fiber optic cable. Is that something you see?
Yeah, and that's sensible from their perspective. Again, sweating the copper is what it's called. They just want to get as much out of it before they have to upgrade to a new kind of network. They're under no requirement from the government and no competitive force from the private market. So we sort of have the worst of both worlds, a kind of private utility that can do whatever it wants.
Thanks again for the call, Ben. We go now to Mike in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of echo what your guest is saying, and I've been in this game for a long time, actually doing private fiber to the home and fiber to the unit business as a project director throughout the United States. And on the Google Fiber Project, the AT&T Light Gig Fiber Project, and then here in the state. And what I'm finding is that there's sort of a double-edged sword. We all want the fiber. We just don't want somebody digging in our front yard. Or we don't have the municipalities that want to necessarily take the risk of having people, you know, digging as much and that. And then you have that generational gap where you have a certain segment of the population that says, you know, I really don't know what good it would do me to Mike, have higher speed.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, your thoughts on Mike's experiences?
I think he's exactly right. And so the Swedes, very sensible and very neat people, decided if you dig up the streets just once and put in a wholesale, it's called dark fiber facility, then you have a whole bunch of competitors share it, and you never have to dig up the streets again. And they did that when they had incumbent cable and telco providers already on the scene because they wanted to avoid the mess. So he's absolutely right about that. He's also right that people were rolling around electric kitchens in the Irish countryside in the 60s. It took a long time to convince people that electricity was worthwhile in the home. And we're seeing the same thing with very high-capacity Internet access these days.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234, talking with Susan Crawford, author of the book Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Back to your calls now. Colin is with us in Green Bay. Colin, hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question. My brother-in-law, she lives in Longmont, Colorado, so they have municipal fiber. So I had actually reached out to my local legislator to see if they had even thought about bringing something to the table or anything in that regard. So I guess my question is, and he said no. He said there is nothing on the table. It's not even being thought about. So from a citizen's perspective, what do I need to do, or like, what can a citizen do to kind of get the ball rolling at the municipal level to try and get that fiber to a smaller town? I'm technically from the pier, so it's about 25,000 people. But what would need to be done, I guess, like, what would the process be to create a pitch to say this is why it would be necessary?
Interesting, Colin. Thanks a lot. So, Susan, what could Colin do in De Pere or anyone in a local community?
Well, Colin's question is terrific, and luckily this whole community is extremely friendly and communicative. So there are small-town municipal utilities in Wisconsin that would be delighted to get on the phone and get you started with information, maybe come give a presentation, might be willing to come in and help you do a feasibility study. What you're really trying to do is give the politicians air cover for what may require bonding, actually raising money to build this initial wholesale dark fiber network. And it's not always easy. So look at Madison that spent years looking at this and did the study, did the feasibility work, and then decided it was just too expensive for the city to raise the bonds, to put out the bonds to raise the money to build the wholesale network. And that politically was just a no-go. And that may happen in your town, but the first step is to just learn as much as you can from very friendly people across the state. Also, there's a wonderful website called muninetworks.org and the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. There's a terrific guy close by, Christopher Mitchell, in Minnesota, who is very aware of the situation in Wisconsin and would be delighted to be helpful. So this is a good time to be thinking about this subject.
Colin, thanks for that call. Going out to Parker with us in Rio. Parker, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Parker?
I live in a small town, which is Rio, town of 1,000 people, and I still have DSL. I don't even get the cable where I live. And now with what happened with net neutrality, I have to pay for 10 megabytes here to get the faster speed.
Parker, thanks for that call. Yeah, still no cable. He said he has to pay a lot to get a faster speed. He's not alone in rural America, right, Susan?
No, in fact, a lot of rural America doesn't have cable at all. They're just they're still dealing with those old copper wires that have never been upgraded. And the telephone companies like CenturyLink and Verizon and AT&T have really backed off from installing wires and are trying to push everybody over to wireless access in rural areas. So there are a lot of shenanigans going on, but again, nothing bad about these companies. We just haven't exerted a strong hand in helping the nation towards a brighter future.
Thanks for the call, Parker. Time for one more call. Dave is with us in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? So, great topic. I live out in the country. I have terrible high-speed access. I'm on a satellite. I can't stand it. My question is, will fiber become less of an issue with 5G on the way?
Oh, great question. So these two things are utterly complementary. You can't have a wireless communication without a wire somewhere nearby. Saying, let's rely on wireless, we don't need a wire, is like saying, let's just use airplanes. Who needs airports? The wireless signal has to go somewhere. And so without really fiber going deep into neighborhoods and into houses, 5G just isn't going to function because you have to have the cells are very, very close together, and you'll have a lot of data going through them, so fiber needs to be nearby. So these two things march together. And in fact, the book, Fiber, is about advanced wireless and fiber because we love wireless. We're going to rely on it, but without a great fiber connection nearby, you won't have those 5G connections.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, in just our last few moments, clearly a lot of people aren't thinking about this yet. Do you see that maybe changing soon in the United States?
I think it will change. I think it's going to require a lot of this local activity and the real evidence of a crisis, and then a real leader who's experienced this. Eisenhower had a bump across the country at 6 miles an hour after the World War I, and that gave him the feeling that maybe we needed a national highway system. These are utterly bipartisan issues, and a leader who gets what a problem this is will, in fact, take charge and do something about it, not by nationalizing these companies, but by insisting that there's a public option everywhere in the country.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my distinct pleasure. I love even thinking about Wisconsin. It's great.
That's Susan Crawford from Harvard Law School. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It.